Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You'll hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and Director of Strategic Initiatives for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby, Policy Director Tori Gorman, Hamilton Project Director and Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution Wendy Edelberg, and Bill Hoagland, a Senior Vice President at the Bipartisan Policy Center, will join the show to discuss COVID-19 relief legislation and the reconciliation process. In fact, we're airing a portion of a recent event followed by another substantive interview, both of which are on timely, newsworthy topics, so we're going to skip our typical Facing the News segment and jump right into the rest of the program. So up next, you'll hear an interview between Concord Coalition Policy Director Tori Gorman and Wendy Edelberg, Director of the Hamilton Project and Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, that took place during a February 17th webinar focused on monetary, fiscal, and economic policy. Edelberg analyzes projected economic effects of COVID-19 relief proposals, one of which is the $1.9 trillion package working its way through the reconciliation process in Congress right now. She engaged in a moderated discussion with Gorman and fields questions from the audience. We'll be back with that discussion after the break. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and you're about to listen to an interview between Concord Coalition Policy Director Tori Gorman and Wendy Edelberg, Director of the Hamilton Project and Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, that took place during a February 17th webinar focused on monetary, fiscal, and economic policy. Edelberg analyzes the economic effects of COVID-19 relief proposals, one of which is the $1.9 trillion package working its way through the reconciliation process in Congress right now, and engages in a moderated discussion, which also includes fielding questions from the audience. This interview has been edited down for length. You can watch the entire discussion and webinar by going to ConcordCoalition.org.
Let me start you off here. You recently wrote a paper analyzing the macroeconomic effects of two competing COVID relief packages, the $618 billion plan offered by 10 Senate Republicans, including notable Senate thought leaders like Bill Cassidy, Susan Collins, Mitt Romney, Rob Portman, but also the $1.9 billion American Rescue Plan proposed by the Biden administration. So I'm curious, what did your analysis show?
Yeah, I am very happy to show you what we found. I did this work with a colleague, Louise Shaner. So in this first picture, let me just walk you through these lines. So this is our analysis of how the full $1.9 trillion Biden package would affect the economy. We estimate that the Biden package would result in real GDP exceeding the current law baseline, by 3.6% at the end of 2021 and 2.1% at the end of 2022. In addition, you can see that real GDP rises above its pre-pandemic path for a time. So what that means is that some of the lost output as a result of the COVID-19 recession would be made up in future quarters. We estimate that there would be a positive output gap between real GDP and the maximum sustainable output of the economy, or potential output. That positive output gap would peak at 2.6% in the first quarter of 2022. So that positive output gap, in our estimation, would put upward pressure on inflation. We think that that upward pressure on inflation would be welcomed by the Federal Reserve. I think that's in line with the comments that we just heard in the previous session. But the temporary surge in economic activity would create a risk of how well the economy fares as it comes down on the other side of that peak. So you can see here that we've projected a soft landing after the peak in 2022, in early 2022, but there are risks associated with how the economy would fare as it slows. So we also analyzed the $618 billion Republican package. And what you can see is that it would raise, in our estimation, it would raise GDP by smaller amounts above the baseline than the Biden package. It would leave GDP about 0.8% below its pre-pandemic trajectory at the end of both 2021 and 2022, but a touch above CBO's estimate of potential GDP. Let me talk a little bit about how we put these numbers together. So in a table, we're going to show you how we broke down the Biden package into different buckets. And so we thought about how the different components of the Biden package would affect the spending of the recipients. So in that first category, the $750 billion you see, so that's all money that we think would be spent essentially by state and local governments or by the federal government. And then you can go all the way down to the smallest package, or the smallest bucket that we put together, which is the $150 billion that we estimate would all essentially be aid to businesses. So that's how we organized the components of the package in order to do this analysis. So with that in mind, if you now go to the third figure, you'll see how those different components were estimated to affect economic activity. And you can see that the largest effect stems from the $750 billion for COVID-19 containment and vaccination, aid to state and local governments, and increased federal spending. That's just because it's the largest size, but also because, in terms of federal outlays, but also because of how we estimate that those federal expenditures would result in spending in the economy. And then the smallest effect is that $150 billion that would be aid to businesses. And again, that's partly because of the small size of just those federal outlays, but also how we estimate that $150 billion of federal outlays would affect the economy. And we did a similar analysis for the Republican package. All of the different components are just estimated to have smaller effects. They have slightly faster effects per dollar. And that's partly because more of the money is targeted, a greater share of the money is targeted to agencies and households that we think are in dire financial straits.
I guess the one thing that stands out for me initially from this analysis is that the Biden plan appears to, the primary objective is to run the economy hot for a period of time above real potential GDP for, I think, 7 to 8 quarters in your model. This obviously comes with some risks, which you briefly mentioned, inflation, for example, higher interest rates, and eventually a reversion to trend GDP. Given that we just heard from the president of the Boston Fed, I'm wondering what assumptions your model makes regarding the Fed's responses to those events.
Yeah, so let me just first step back and say that I think in terms of primary objectives, at least the way the Biden administration has described their primary objectives, they have a number of them beyond, I think, what they view as a good thing, which is running the economy hot for a time. I think their primary objective is the money that goes out the door to keep the pandemic under control, to distribute the vaccine, to reopen schools. I think they have a lot of objectives that they are trying to address in this package. But it's true that to think about how monetary policy would respond to these economic to this change in economic activity, that was a really critical part of our analysis. And in our estimation, the Fed would not try to so much lean against this economic activity. They would recognize that the pressure on inflation that they would see would be a temporary surge in inflation, and they would see through that. They would have a lot of, you know, excellent economists projecting that inflation was going to come down quite quickly, I think, as the economy slows. So I don't expect that they would raise the interest rates in response to the increase in inflation. That would be a pop that they would welcome. But what they would have, a challenging time doing, it's not beyond their abilities, but a challenging time doing, is managing the economy coming down on the other side. But roughly speaking, broadly speaking, what our analysis rested on is that the Fed would welcome this increase in economic activity and not try to dampen aggregate demand in response.
So largely accommodative is what I hear you
say. Largely accommodative, that's okay. Right.
Got it. So given that there are some of these potential risks with running the economy a little hot, do you have any suggestions for policymakers on how to mitigate some of these longer term risks? For example, how to increase the probability of a soft landing, you know, once real GDP returns to trend?
So I am absolutely worried about that soft landing. I am worried that with a surge in economic activity, businesses will have a difficult time teasing out how much of that surge in economic activity is just because everybody really loves their particular restaurant, and this is the time that they should expand into the empty space next door. This is the time to buy the extra pizza oven. I'm worried about people who have good, stable jobs being offered new jobs that have higher salaries, but it turns out that those new jobs are completely dependent on the surge in activity. And, you know, so they leave their stable job, they take the new job, and then that new job disappears when the activity slows. So I am worried about all of those sorts of difficult transitions as the economy slows. I think that there are pretty straightforward ways to tweak the $1.9 trillion package to mitigate those risks. Slowing the money down, slowing the federal outlays down is just one obvious way to do it, so that it's more of a sustained boost to economic activity and less of a temporary surge that all takes place within a couple of quarters. Making more of the package dependent on how the economy is doing. There are ways to do that are relatively straightforward. And keeping more money in reserve just in case the economy needs it and the recovery is not robust. So the absolute most urgent thing to do is enact a big package now. And I don't want to suggest anything that gets in the way of that outcome, but I do think that there are ways to adjust the package to mitigate these risks.
You were talking about slowing some of the rate of spending. Are there any particular categories within this broader package that in particular you're pointing at?
So, you know, if policymakers want to come to me and let me offer these tweaks, one of the tweaks I would suggest is, rather than sending out the checks to households in one lump sum, spreading out that aid to households, that fiscal support to households, spreading that out more over time, I think would create more of a sustained recovery going forward, rather than what could end up being a big jolt in economic activity that our economy has a difficult time absorbing. I think some of the money that is being set aside to help state and local governments, on the one hand, I already think that money would be spent out by state and local governments slowly, but there are ways to ensure that state and local governments spend that slowly, for example, by tying more of that aid to infrastructure spending. So we know that investment in infrastructure is slow because it takes time to put projects in place. It then takes time to build them. It takes time for that to increase economic activity. And we know that we need to do more to invest in our public infrastructure. So tying more of that aid to state and local governments to infrastructure investment would be a way to slow down some of the economic effects. And also create, you know, a more efficient economy, you know, in the years ahead.
Got it. Understood. So let's switch gears for a moment and talk about methodology. Your analysis judges these plans in terms of their impact on the output gap. And Bob talked about this earlier with Phil Swagel, the output gap being the difference between actual and potential GDP. Question, is this the right approach to policy prescriptions when potential GDP itself is an estimate, which makes the output gap, you know, even more uncertain? Would it be more appropriate, for example, and perhaps a better use of federal tax dollars to design a relief program from the bottom up, for example, rather than from the top down, one that targets relief to those who need it most, Or is that really just sort of a public policy pipe dream because the federal government really doesn't do a good job of targeting relief? It's sort of this tension between we need to get the money out quickly, but if we're going to target it, we've got to slow it down and create all these filters.
Yeah, I think basically everything you just said is right. But I think we need to do both. We need to both walk and chew gum. And it's my impression that when policymakers are putting together these packages, they are thinking about both goals, as well as, I mean, let me throw three goals in the mix. So one, we need a package that makes sure that we have all of the possible resources in place to fight the pandemic, distribute the vaccine, and contain the health crisis. So that's one huge priority. Another huge priority is making sure that we get relief to households and businesses that need that relief now, urgently. There are households that are under enormous financial pressure. There are businesses, particularly small businesses, that are at risk of failing and would remain viable and would be a source of labor demand and you know, great economic activity post-pandemic if they could make it through this period. We know that some state and local governments are in dire financial straits, trying to, you know, and not using the resources, not because they don't have the resources or they're afraid to use the resources to invest to get schools open. So we know that there are urgent needs right now. And we need a package that gets money out to those people and those agencies and those businesses right now. And then the third goal is making sure that we have all the pieces in place for a robust recovery. The good news is that there's a lot of overlap in what provisions in how provisions would achieve those goals. So if we get the money out right now urgently to the people who are in dire financial straits, that will make those people better able to maintain their demand for goods and services over the next four quarters, let's say, and be, you know, great contributors to economic activity and make sure that we have a robust recovery. So it turns out we can do all three and basically in one big package. But yes, those are all goals.
Mm-hmm. So in looking at these two different packages, you know, just from the graphs that you put forward, it kind of seems like the Republican package, you know, sort of hits that little sweet spot. And again, talking about that, the Biden package, you know, it runs the economy hot for a little while. I've heard you make comments about how lawmakers need an insurance policy. So in evaluating these two approaches to COVID relief, can you talk a little bit about that comment? I found that very interesting.
It absolutely isn't. Doing more is an insurance policy. So I cannot overstate the uncertainty underlying all of our estimates. Thinking about what the economy would do over time without additional fiscal support, that's subject to enormous uncertainty. What the potential output of the economy is subject to enormous uncertainty. And thinking about how the potential output of the economy is actually contingent on what we do with regards to the pandemic, what we do with regards to economic activity. And then finally, it's incredibly uncertain how the economy will respond to additional fiscal support. We're talking about numbers that our models, you know, we don't have a lot of good history to help guide us of how the economy responds to this level of this extent of fiscal support. Right. So given all that, it is hard to know whether or not our estimates are that the Republican package just gets us above potential. If we're wrong on any one of those sources of our estimates, we could be significantly undershooting. And so the Biden package is an expensive and very large, but probably very effective insurance policy.
Got it. Understood. So I'm going to shift gears a little bit and take some questions from the audience. You've written a lot about automatic stabilizers to ensure economic relief is not prematurely cut off before the economy is fully recovered. What about the flip side of that? Now, what do you think about using two-sided automatic stabilizers that also trigger some form of deficit reduction if relief spending ends up being more than is desirable or needed?
Well, I think that that's at the crux of what automatic stabilizers do. We have, particularly in our tax system, very significant automatic stabilizers under current law, long before the pandemic. It's a critical part of our tax system. When a person's income is lower, they pay less in taxes. When a person's income is higher, they pay more in taxes. We don't simply tell, you know, each individual in the economy, this is how much you owe in taxes, regardless of how your income was last year. So our tax system automatically adjusts in a way that it turns out we think helps to stabilize the economy. So the fact that when you make more in your labor market income, you pay more in taxes means that there's basically a stabilizing influence on your income. The fact that a business pays more in sales taxes when their revenue is higher is a stabilizing influence on economic activity. So that the two-sided nature of automatic stabilizers is built into the system. Mm-hmm. But what I think is partly implicit in that question is also, active fiscal policy it's not an automatic stabilizer, it's an active stabilizer. And it's true that we do more often see policymakers in times when the economy is weak, putting in place fiscal support to boost the economy, relative to when times are strong, putting in place policies that dampen, you know, economic growth and increase revenues and decrease spending.
That's exactly right. My concern is that when the economy starts doing well, what do? They cut taxes. And that's not the deficit reduction other side that we're looking for. So
indeed.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's a political economy question. The only part that I would say with my economist hat on is that given the low rate of interest rates right now, we're going to have a very challenging time. If the world of low interest rates remains, we're going to be putting more and more pressure on fiscal policy relative to monetary policy to be the game in town that helps to boost the economy when economic growth is weak. So I do think going forward, fiscal policymakers will see that they have more of a role to boost economic growth than they have to dampen economic growth. So that's just one thing to add to the mix of how complicated this is going to be.
I'm going to throw one last question in here, and I'm going to admit that this comes from one of my children from sitting at the dining room table. She says, I think we need to do everything we can to fight this virus, but we entered this pandemic with a lot of government debt and big deficits. When will it be appropriate to start worrying about the deficit and debt again? And when can we actually do something about it without hurting the economic recovery?
I think you have excellent conversations around your dining room table.
She's a good girl.
So, you know, I'm very much informed by CBO's projections and what their projections are of interest rates and what I see the projections of interest rates in financial markets. And I see that CBO basically is looking at these long-term pressures on spending and looking at revenues under current law. And at the end of this decade, we do indeed start to see debt to GDP start to rise and then rise without bound. That suggests to me that over the next handful of years, we should be making some difficult decisions to change that long-term trajectory. There is no shortage of ideas. You know, one thing that I find frustrating is when I tell people about these long-term trends that are worrisome, and people say, but it's such a difficult challenge, you know, like we need better ideas. We need to explain the issues to policymakers. It's actually a very simple problem with pretty simple solutions. And we have no shortage of ideas here. We just need to make some difficult political choices over the next few years and decide what we care about as a society. These are difficult political issues, not difficult technical issues. So yeah, over the next few years, it would be really great if we made these difficult choices as a society.
This is Facing the Future. You've been listening to an interview between Concord Coalition Policy Director Tori Gorman and Wendy Edelberg, Director of the Hamilton Project and Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, that took place during a February 17th webinar focused on monetary, fiscal, and economic policy. As a reminder, this interview has been edited down for length. You can watch the entire discussion and webinar by going to ConcordCoalition.org. Up next, Tori will join me, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, and Bill Hoagland, a Senior Vice President at the Bipartisan Policy Center, for a discussion on evaluating the reconciliation process and whether it's time for a change. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Tori Gorman, Bob Bixby, and Bill Hoagland. You know Bob and Tori well, Concord Coalition Executive Director and Policy Director, respectively. They're regular contributors on the show. Bill is a Senior Vice President at the Bipartisan Policy Center. He helps direct and manage fiscal, health, and economic policy analyses. He's also an affiliate professor of public policy at the George Mason University. Before joining BPC in 2012, Bill served as Vice President of Public Policy for Cigna. Prior to that, he completed 33 years of federal government service, including 25 years on the U.S. Senate staff. From 2003 to 2007, he served as the Director of Budget and Appropriations in the office of Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. From 82 to 2003, Bill served as a staff member and director of the Senate Budget Committee. He participated in major federal budget negotiations, including the 1985 Graham-Rudman-Hollings Budget Deficit Reduction Act, the 1990 Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act, and the historic 1997 Balanced Budget Agreement. Bill was also one of the first employees of the Congressional Budget Office in 1975, working with its first director, the late Alice Rivlin. Welcome to Facing the Future, Bob, Tori, and Bill.
Good morning.
Happy to have you all here on the program today, and we're talking about a topic that's been in the news quite a bit lately, from COVID-19 relief legislation to the reconciliation process, which is the vehicle that Bill is currently enjoying right now. And given Tori and Bill, your experience on Capitol Hill over the years, I thought it would be good to kick it off with sort of a general discussion of what reconciliation was meant to be and how it's evolved over the years. And we'll start with you, Bill.
Oh, thank you. Good to be with you and good to be with the Concord Coalition. I remember the establishment of it under Senator Rudman, and it goes back a long way, but I really think that the work you do, Bob, and you and Chase and Tori do is just important to a continuation on the issues that I'm most concerned about in terms of that's the fiscal sustainability of this country. As it relates to reconciliation, of course, it was established as part of the original Budget Act for one particular reason was we used to do two budget resolutions. We did one in the spring and one did in the fall. And the point being that the one in the fall was to be reconciled with the one in the spring. Eventually that evolved into just having one budget resolution, and it takes a lot of time to put a budget resolution together. And so it became one budget resolution, and reconciliation then became part of that first budget resolution, which was the term is to effectuate the policies to achieve the budget outcomes that were specified in that blueprint budget resolution that's been adopted. You don't have to have reconciliation. I think of the 45-year history of the budget resolution, I think we've only had about 21, 22 reconciliation bills. But over time, throughout at least the 80s, the first budget reconciliation bill was done in under the Carter administration at the end of the 1980. I always remember that it was a Democratic-controlled Congress, and this had this upstart governor out there in California who was making a big deal out of a deficit of $75 billion. And it turned out that Congress said, well, wait a minute, we got to do something about this deficit. And so the first budget resolution for fiscal year 80, before Reagan became elected, was done under the Carter administration and Democratic controlled, and there was a $8 billion instruction to save money off of the deficit. I think it was $8 billion. I remember it well because I had something to do with the estimates of that when I was at the Congressional Budget Office dealing with the child nutrition programs, but we won't go there right now. The end product was that throughout the 80s and almost all throughout the 90s, reconciliation was looked at as a way make changes in, and I want to emphasize this, make changes in existing programs, not the creation of new programs. And I've gone around with the parliamentarians, former parliamentarians, they agree that this was always meant to be make changes to achieve a budgetary outcome, which throughout those years was assumed to be deficit reduction. And it evolved. And as you mentioned, very kindly, the last major, close to the last major resolution I worked on in a reconciliation bill was the 1997 one, which brought us to, along with actions that had been taken place in 1990 and 1993, that basically helped us get to a balanced budget for 98. It also had something to do with a very strong economy during those periods. But all this led up, and then it's evolved further. We actually achieved balance. In fact, we had projected surpluses, and maybe this is when it started to get off the rails, because we had a surplus, and the incoming Bush administration in 2001 said, wait a minute, let's return this surplus to the American public in the form of a tax cut. And out of that became, with, by the way, in 2001, a 50-50 Senate. Sounds familiar. And so it turned out that that to achieve that, returning that tax cut was a decision made to use reconciliation to make a tax cut, not reduce a deficit, but to reduce a surplus. And maybe that was the genie that opened the bottle or whatever, because from that point on, well, if Republicans can use reconciliation to make tax cuts, then why can't Democrats use reconciliation to do spending increases? And I think the evolution is to where we are today, where this current reconciliation bill, and I'm not suggesting that we don't have a need to address this COVID crisis. There's clearly a need, but this reconciliation process, because of, again, a 50-50 Senate, and quite frankly, more than anything else, to get around the 60 vote filibuster in the Senate, this has become the tool of a preference, let's say, for legislating. And that's where we are today, as we've got to the current situation with a reconciliation bill that will actually add at least $1.9 trillion to the deficit over the next 10 years.
I think you hit the nail right on the head, is that each new Congress that has a whack at a reconciliation bill tries to push the envelope a little bit further about what they can achieve in reconciliation. And I think one thing that people don't seem to recall is that what you create in reconciliation, you can undo in reconciliation as well. I mean, I think I've said this over and over again, the only way to create durable legislation, long-lasting legislation, is through the normal process, where the committee creates a bill, they mark up a bill, they send it to the floor, it's amended on the floor, it's sent to the other chamber, there's a conference, and then it passes and it's sent to the president. Otherwise, you get this, constantly evolving tax code that's moving in one direction and then the other. You've got, mandatory spending programs that are going one direction, then going another. And it's bad for the economy. It's bad for people. It's bad for government. It's bad for lawmakers. It's just a bad way to do business.
But let me jump in here and ask both of our congressional experts about the Byrd rule, because with reconciliation comes the Byrd rule, which has a lot of technicalities, but an overall rationale behind it. Bill, you want to talk about what the Byrd rule is and how that came about?
The rationale behind it, as you say, there was a rationale behind it. In fact, it was in the around the 1980s when Senator Majority Leader Howard Baker, a Republican, and Minority Leader Robert Byrd, the Democrat, came together and said, we had a reconciliation instruction to a particular committee, and I always my memory is foggy on this, but I think it was a reconciliation instruction to the Committee of Jurisdiction, which was the Commerce Committee, to raise some fees for Coast Guard user fee. And Senator Frist Hollings was on that, was a part of that committee. And he said, oh, this is great. I'll do that. I'll raise your Coast Guard user fees. But I just happen to have this bill that I haven't been able to get across the floor because it requires 60 votes. And since the budget committee can't make any changes to what we report to them, I'm going to just stick that into my to the fees and send it to the floor. And Senator Byrd and Senator Baker said, wait a minute. That's not what this process was meant to do. It's not meant to become an opening for legislation, authorizations, and legislation that has nothing to do with the budget instruction you got. And they came to an agreement at that particular time. It was a rule in the Senate. In fact, by the way, this really applies almost entirely just to the Senate, which the House is finding out is very uncomfortable to them. But the bottom line is that then we codified that, saying, listen, there are about four or five provisions, one being that if a report or provision has no budgetary consequence at all, and that's quite frankly an easy one to determine by looking at the scoring. If they report legislation in their reconciliation that's not within their committee's jurisdiction, that's out of it. Senator Jesse Helms used to do something like that when he was a Foreign Relations Committee chairman and moved something that had to do with tobacco tax, which was not in his jurisdiction. If it touches Social Security, you can't do that. But the big one and the most difficult one and the one that makes parliamentarians go crazy is if the provision, maybe it does have a budgetary consequence, but is it merely incidental to the overall goal? And that's the one that causes most of the heartache that has to deal with determining whether or not a provision in a reconciliation bill should remain or not.
There's a lot in the news right now when it comes to reconciliation and the parliamentarian, especially when it comes to the minimum wage increase that was attempted to be put in the bill. And it looks like the Senate will kick it, will give it the bird. And I'm curious, you know, the parliamentarian has taken a lot of heat for saying that she said it violates the Byrd rule. That was the recommendation. And is she a good scapegoat or a victim in this process in terms of being a target of so much animosity when it comes to a part of the bill like this?
Well, I think that, first of all, it is a thankless job being a Senate parliamentarian, a thankless job, but a critical job. My heart goes out to the parliamentarian. That is a tough, tough job, particularly as it relates to this determination that puts a lot of pressure. Now, let's remember, she merely advises the president pro tem, whoever's sitting in. She doesn't make the final decision. The final decision is made by the presiding officer of the Senate, and they don't have to follow her advice. But generally, in the history, I've seen about once or twice in my history up there where there was the president pro tem did not follow advice. But no, is she a victim today? I think it's unfair. I think she looked at this very carefully as it relates to the minimum wage. Tory may have a different take on how the decision was made. She didn't consult with me, I can assure you. She didn't. She looked at it, and I think she probably concluded that, wait a minute, here we go again. Is this really part of what was designed to be a COVID bill? It has benefits, clearly. It does have a budgetary consequence now, according to the kind of the secondary scoring of it or the dynamic scoring. But I could make the argument, number one, that it's merely incidental, falls into that merely incidental. Yes, $52 billion sounds like a big number, but remember, wages over the next 10 years is something like $140 trillion. And so in that context, it's less than a dot. And that plus also a technical issue as to relates to the Committee of Jurisdiction of the Senate that did not have the money to cover the $52 billion. I think the bottom line was that was a decision that you made the right decision. And unfortunately, those who feel, particularly those in the House who do not understand this process and why it was established the way it was, I think are giving are are, are really making a mistake by attacking the parliamentarian.
Yeah, let me just glom onto what Bill is saying there. I think a lot of progressives are not really taking the appropriate perspective when it comes to her decision on the minimum wage, especially with respect to survival of the coronavirus relief bill in the Senate. There were not enough votes for the COVID relief bill in the Senate with the minimum wage in it. We know we already have Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema from Arizona on record as saying that they would not support the bill with that in it. So the fact that she determined via her analysis of Senate precedent and the Byrd rule that the minimum wage was not appropriate for the American Rescue Act, I think she saved the bill. I think she made it possible to pass the bill in the Senate. Otherwise, Senator Schumer would have had a devil of a time trying to corral the 50 votes that he needs in the Senate to get this passed, knowing, of course, that the vice president will provide the 51st vote that gets it across the line. So I would really hope that those on the left that are really upset about this minimum wage provision would take a broader perspective, a broader view, and understand what her guidance and her opinion has done to the survivability of that bill in the Senate. And instead of castigating her in public, actually, you know, pat her on the back, and Schumer should send her a dozen roses.
There are two other aspects to the Byrd rule worthy of note. One that Bill will remember well is the fact that it can't increase the deficit beyond the 10-year budget window. And that explains, over the past several years, some of these fiscal cliffs that come up because people write bills. And then in order to say, well, it's not going to have an effect beyond the next 10 years, you just simply write a provision that it's going to expire. Another aspect that seems to be new this year is the vast amount of discretionary spending that is stuffed into this bill. And I always thought that reconciliation was about mandatory spending and revenues, not about the appropriations process and where you get all the discretionary funding going through. But a lot of this in the COVID bill seems to be what would be traditionally discretionary spending. Has that jumped out at you, Bill, or is that something to worry about, or no big deal?
No, absolutely. Number one, Corey's made this comment before, and I agree with her 100%. Reconciliation is not necessarily the best way to write legislation. And that's why, if you want long-term sustainable legislation, you don't do reconciliation. You do it through the old-fashioned way of arguing it out and authorizing and working it out through the committees. So number one, the 10-year cliff, as an example, after the period of time, that's an example of bad legislation. I mean, you should have permanency in some of this. But anyway, but on the issue of authorization for appropriations, number one, 1981, that first reconciliation bill by the Reagan administration did reconcile authorizations. Because it says you can make changes in levels of authorization. The issue was, though, that the committees it's an authorized level, not the actual spending. And so the Byrd rule came along later and said, listen, because it's an authorization subject to later action by appropriation, it has no budgetary consequence. So what has happened is, as a result, right now, because we are operating under caps for discretionary spending for the current fiscal year 21. When this particular bill came up in terms of the additional emergency spending for COVID, most of it would have been appropriated. In fact, the $900 billion, I don't know exactly how much of that, but a large portion of that was discretionary. Well, had they gone the route of emergency supplemental regular route appropriations, they would have faced the 60 vote hurdle. And so I am convinced that the reason why you're seeing all this authorization and appropriation, basically converting those programs that were subject to appropriations into direct spending programs, probably the worst decision going. It's why we have it. And I agree with you. I would say of the 1.9, close to $800 billion of it, and that's roughly my estimate, is that which would normally be appropriated. It was appropriated in the CARES Act. It was appropriated back in the other acts.
We've acknowledged reconciliation is basically used to avoid filibuster. It doesn't result in great legislation. Is it time to kick reconciliation to the curb? What do you do with filibuster? Walk us through that. What are your thoughts there?
Very quickly, I would simply say that it has clearly evolved into something that the authors of the Congressional Budget Impairment Control Act never envisioned it becoming. It has the irony of ironies, a particular piece of legislation that was designed to control the deficit, maintain fiscal sustainability, has now become an instrument for upsetting fiscal sustainability for the future. So yes, I think it's time to change. It's an easy change. You can go back and simply say you can only use it to reduce the deficit. You don't have to do away with it entirely, but it has become a tool that is just simply designed to get around the filibuster. And I think that that's unfortunate.
This is Facing the Future. You've been listening to Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, Policy Director Tori Gorman, and Senior Vice President at the Bipartisan Policy Center Bill Hoagland discuss the reconciliation process and whether it's time for a change. Thank you for joining the show, Bob, Tori, and Bill.
Thank you.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.